It's Christmas, and not to spoil any holiday cheer, but a whole lot of investors have little more than coal in their stockings, even though the economy, it's still chugging along. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday. Merry Christmas. Thanks for being with us. Not to be the downer here, but that's the job I have today. It's been a rough month for the stock market. Specifically, the Dow and S&P 500 are both off almost 16% this month. Those 401k envelopes are becoming way less fun to open. But it's not all doom and gloom. For more, we have Marketplace's Justin Ho here. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Adrienne.
Just to underscore why this is significant, why it's a big deal, December's traditionally a pretty good month for the markets, right?
Yeah, and there's even this thing called the Santa Claus rally. That's the idea that on average, markets have gone up during the last week of December. And all that sounds rather quaint now, doesn't it?
Right.
There's nothing quiet or cheerful about your 401k dropping 16% in a month. And not only are stocks dropping, oil is dropping too. And, you know, look around the rest of the world. Japan's Nikkei index just went into bear market territory. U.S. government bonds, which people often buy when everyone's selling their stocks, they've been rising. And you see that in the yields, which move in the opposite direction of prices. Bond yields are down.
So is there a flip side to this? I mean, this morning, President Trump said American companies are, quote, the greatest in the world, and that the market slump represents a, quote, tremendous opportunity to buy.
Yeah, all these stocks that are dropping, they're the stocks of companies whose earnings have been, you know, pretty strong on average this year. And before this drop we've seen, stocks were expensive. Even now, the S&P 500 is still up about 9% since Trump's election. But either way, the market has been finding plenty of reasons to sell.
Where's that pessimism coming from?
Well, you know, there's the ongoing shutdown over the border wall, and let's just not forget the trade war. Markets have not been happy with all the tariff fights we've been having. And, you know, for instance, remember there was that meeting between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping?
Mm-hmm.
Trump said it was highly successful. The word truce was floating around. There was a steak dinner. Markets loved it the Monday after, but then Tuesday comes around and people started questioning whether anything was actually agreed upon. And then the Dow drops 800 points.
That's right around the time of the tariff man tweet, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you can pull up a monthly graph of the S&P 500 and you can see what I'm talking about.
We know, we say a lot on the show, the stock market is not the economy. The economy is not the stock market. Taking a step back from yesterday's news, from this month of stock market news, how's the actual economy doing?
Well, there are plenty of signs that the economy is still strong. We've seen steady and consistent gains in job growth, for instance, and wages. And we're in an economy with a really tight labor market. And that means companies are struggling to find enough workers to fill their open positions. And, you know, people have also not been shy about holiday spending. There's already data showing that we're spending a record amount on the holiday season this year. And I mentioned oil. Oil dropping means that gas prices are cheaper, heating your home's cheaper, and that's a stimulus. So overall, we're still in one of the longest economic expansions in history.
What are the signs out there about where this economy could be going?
So GDP has been hovering in the 3% range this year, and economists expect it to slow down to around the 2% range in the near future. And interest rates are also going to keep rising. Economists expect about two rises in 2019 so far. You know, that affects mortgage rates, for instance. We've been reporting a lot about how we're starting to see signs of a slowdown in the housing market.
How does pessimism in the stock market sort of leak over into the broader economy?
Well, it depends on who you ask, because there's a lot of people in the economy who are just not involved in the market. There's a lot of people who don't have any retirement savings and have never had a job that gives them benefits in a 401k. But for retirees, people approaching their, you know, retirement age who might need to draw from their savings and actually, you know, spend money in this economy, they're going to be looking at the stock market drops and they're going to be worried. They're going to be saying, should I withdraw money now? Should I wait for the market to turn upward? Either way, the market is not the economy, but the market is going to be on a lot of people's minds this holiday season.
Marketplace's Justin Ho. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, tune in to the Marketplace Morning Report as we get a better sense of where the markets are headed. Today, a day off for U.S. investors. So coming up, we'll do the numbers holiday style.
Thank you.
It's too early to tell if the gap between the fundamentals of the economy and the market will narrow for consumers. But it's not there yet. We're still spending. Retail sales, if you leave out cars, were up more than 5% from November through the middle of last week. That's according to new numbers from MasterCard. Not surprisingly, online sales continue to eat away at brick and mortar. But are we getting a better deal when we shop online than when we go to a store? From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Portland's Lloyd Center Mall was packed a few days before Christmas. An indoor ice rink was crowded with families as live hip-hop blared from a stage. Andre Middleton was there for the music. He rarely comes to the mall, favors locally owned stores, also shops online, and says he's inundated with emailed discount offers.
If I happen to come upon a particular sale that is it's here today, and if I'm in the market for that particular item, I'll make the impulse buy and get it.
Impulse buying, that's exactly what online retailers want consumers to do.
They're looking to trigger a transaction on the spot.
Mark Cohen at the Columbia Business School says big retailers like Walmart and Target that have lots of stores and robust websites would just as soon we all shop online so they can mine our data.
They can use a cookie to find you if you've clicked on anything that they carry. They can adjust prices, whether it's couponing or deeper discounts, literally on a momentary basis.
And buying online can be cheaper. A recent MIT study found that retailers' online prices were lower for 22% of items. In-store prices were lower for just 8%. 70% of prices were about the same. But Bert Flickinger at the Strategic Research Group says once they've hooked you online, retailers still want you to stop by the store to pick up a purchase, do a return.
A person who buys online that subsequently goes to the store will spend an extra 40 to 45% more in the store.
And when you shop in person, some retailers are willing to honor a lower price from their website if you ask. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One factor in the sinking stock market could be, as Justin mentioned, all the tariff battles the Trump administration is fighting. Battles big and small. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Commerce announced tariffs on Spanish olives, a market worth more than $65 million. The U.S. made the case that the industry is being propped up by the European Union. Since then, Spanish olive imports have plummeted. The BBC's Ashish Sharma took a visit to one of the regions most affected by the tariffs.
Another tractor rolls up to the weighing bay loaded with olives. I am at a processing factory in a village called Arajal, just outside the city of Seville in the south of Spain. The village's economy and social life is knitted together by small farms that all grow olives. And as the rain lashes down, lines of yellow and green tractors wait patiently to dump their loads before heading back to collect more olives. But inside the factory, farmers look on with worried expressions. Their mood is dark and tinged with anger. These olives are destined for the United States. But recent U.S. tariffs placed on the import of table olives from Spain has left the market deep in crisis. Exports have fallen by nearly a half, and for farmers like Jose Maria, their future is as gloomy as the rain lashing outside.
80% of the olives that we gather are for the American market, so this is going to really hurt us and the industry, especially the farmers who grow olives. We just don't know what's going to happen next year, but it's a really big problem if farmers stop growing olives because they can't cover the costs of producing and harvesting them.
Well, I'm just entering a wonderful little cafe here in Seville, which is just around the corner from the offices of the organisation which protects the rights of all of the exporters of table olives. The organisation is called Asamesa, and Antonio de Mora, who is the chief executive, has very kindly taken some time out to talk to me. Antonio, can you explain a little bit about what is the problem right now that the farmers are facing?
We have lost about 45% of the US market, and we are working with the European Union in order they present the case in the World Trade Organization.
American farmers have successfully argued that Spanish olives are sold at less than fair value because of subsidies received from the European Union through the Common Agricultural Policy. As a result, anti-subsidy tariffs have been in place since last year. Jaime Malet is the president of the U.S. Chambers of Commerce here in Spain.
Subsidizing industries to protect sectors and jobs can be perfectly supported. But when these sectors, with these subsidies, go to other countries and export their goods or services because they have the backup of taxpayers' money in home countries, this is unfair.
Back on the farms, and Joaquin Garcia is looking at how he can diversify his business. His family have been growing olives for many generations, and he has no plans to give up without a fight. He's now considering becoming a producer of olive oil.
We're hoping that once we've collected the olives, we can mechanically produce olive oil. That's our best option so that we don't lose these olives. It means we'll have to spend well over €1,000 to adapt the machines, but it's the only way forward.
The olive industry in this part of Spain employs nearly 8,000 people, and jobs are at risk if the US tariffs continue.
The BBC's Ashish Sharma. Coming up?
So the very first article came out in New Zealand, the second one in the Netherlands.
The whole world seems to love avocados. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed today, a gift in and of itself after yesterday's dive. So we're going to do the numbers with a holiday-ish theme. If you've been staying with family and friends over the holidays, you might be feeling a little stressed. Two-thirds of people polled by Motel 6 said they expected to feel stressed in these situations because of things like not enough room, no privacy. Just over 80% told the hotel chain they would appreciate a gift of, you guessed it, a hotel stay. According to research from Facebook, 16% of people said they felt stressed about making sure they brought something delicious to impress other guests. Thank you, Instagram. And when it comes to dealing with all that stress, roughly 20% of people surveyed by Remedy Review said they chug a little extra eggnog. Where would we be without corporate research? U.S. markets will be back in business tomorrow. Happy holidays. You're listening to Marketplace.
Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you trust, and the payoff comes with what you hear every day. Don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Please give today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. The Brexit deadline is now only a few months away, March 29, 2019, and British Prime Minister Theresa May is trying to get ready. She's called her senior ministers back in early from their Christmas break to work on plans for whatever happens next, deal or no deal. For British citizens in the UK now, if your spouse or family are outside the European Economic Area, there's a minimum income requirement in order to allow your family to apply for a visa. But with Brexit on on the horizon, that policy could expand to thousands of additional British families living in Europe, making it harder for kids to see their parents. The BBC's Olivia Craylan reports.
Ready? Bum, 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 bum. Where's your daddy? Where's your daddy?
Alia. Hey. Alia.
Alia, come here. Alia crawls towards her daddy. His arms are outstretched and he is cooing encouragement. But when she arrives to the other side of the room, he can't pick her up. It's because he's on a screen over 2,000 kilometres away in Morocco and has never met his daughter in person.
Kill her.
I miss a lot of things. Alia started crawling. I wasn't there. Alia was sick. I wasn't there. I always feeling so guilty for not being there.
Abdu, his nine-month-old daughter Alia, and British wife Becky are a Skype family. It's the nickname given to thousands of couples and families separated and living in different countries because of UK immigration laws. The law states that a British spouse with a partner from outside the European Economic Area must earn a minimum salary of just over $23,500 to qualify to apply for a visa for their partner or family members. 40% of the UK population would not qualify.
Our family life is literally over Skype. Abdu is watching all the most important milestones of Alia's first years over a camera. I'm forced to be a single mum because of the policies.
Did you go to school today?
Daddy.
Yes.
I miss you.
Tom's been separated from his wife Annie and son Dandan, who live in the Philippines, for a year after failing to qualify financially for the visa. The separation quickly took a toll on his mental health.
I was often kind of breaking down in tears when I saw families together or hear music with, you know, references to families or children. For me, that shouldn't be happening to me, you know.
Tom feels he has one option left to get his family to the UK, a move to Ireland in order to attempt what's known as the Surrender Singh route. Named after a historic court case, this route means that Brits who move to the EU with their non-EEA partner for at least 6 months can return to the UK without needing a qualifying salary, thanks to Europe's freedoms of movement. But with the UK's EU membership coming to an end, time is running out for those attempting or contemplating that route. The Home Office told the BBC that those who come to the UK via the Surrender Singh route will only be able to apply under the EU settlement scheme if they do so before the end of the planned implementation period. Brexit may even mean that Brits living in the EU and married to a European will need to qualify financially if they want to return to the UK together in the future. Susie's been living in Brussels for 18 years and has two children with her French partner. But she's worried about her elderly mother still living on her own in the UK.
I came over here in 2000 as an EU worker, as, you know, travelling around as we could at that time. If somebody had asked me at that time, if you go, it's a one-way ticket, possibly I'd have thought differently about it.
For many, a one-way ticket to join their family is all they want. But time is running out for those hoping that Europe will hold the key.
The BBC's Olivia Craylan. This seems to be the age of the avocado. From avocado toast to avocado t-shirts, avocados have come to represent a whole generation and their priorities. The United States imported over $2.5 billion of avocado in 2017. Per capita avocado consumption has tripled since the beginning of the 2000s. I ate an avocado for lunch today. Last year, a restaurant called Avocadoria opened its doors in Manhattan and declared itself the world's first avocado bar. Alessandro Bigi and Francesco Bracchetti, the Italian co-founders of the restaurant, have a second location in New York and big plans to expand. When they came into our studios, I asked Francesco why he thinks the world needs avocado-themed restaurants.
We saw avocado as the perfect fruit to kind of sending our message to our customers. And if you really think about, avocado is kind of a unique fruit because on one side, it's very healthy, but on the other side, it's also a fat fruit. And on top of that, it's also extremely versatile. So we love avocado. We try to use it in all the dishes. And now you really see avocado restaurants popping up in Europe, in Latin America, in Southeast Asia. So it's really a global phenomenon. So I really think that the world needs an avocado bar.
It's interesting because every time, you know, we meet someone and say, yeah, we have two restaurants in New York. Like, oh, nice. So where's your pizza place? So where's your pasta? Like, no, actually, we do everything with avocado. Like, what? That's cool. And so, yeah.
How does Instagram fit into your origin story? What role did it play?
Well, Instagram was a great way for us to understand if there was basically interest or not around the concept. So, you know, in the tech space, before you start, building like properly the software and the company, you create what it's called the MVP, which means a minimum viable product. So basically, you know, the smallest piece of code or software you can put out in order to test the interest. And so we're like, okay, how can we create an MVP for a restaurant? Like, it's really hard. You still need a lot of money and resources and so on. And so we said, okay, you know what? Let's open this Instagram account. Let's call it Avocaderia. Let's say that we are the first avocado bar in the world and we're opening soon in New York. And just from Instagram, we started getting a lot of interest and getting the first article. So the very first article came out in New Zealand, the second one in the Netherlands. And the third one was
before there's any food at all.
Oh, way before there was even thinking about making an avocado bar. And so the funny thing is that I think one of those articles, maybe the one from South Africa and so on, ended with the question, does the world need an avocado bar? And there was yes and no, it was a survey, and 90% of the people responded yes. And so we're like, yeah, that's exactly what we were looking for as our confirmation. And we said, okay, you know what, we should really do this.
So your business is centered on this fruit, and the price of avocados, as those of us who grocery shop for them know at least, can be really volatile. What do you guys do if there's a bad harvest or if there's talk of a tariff on avocados from Mexico? What's the business plan there?
Okay, so first is that we don't adjust pricing based on the volatility of the produce.
So it's not going to go to like market price like a fish?
No. Once we decide, so we use average pricing during the year to allow our pricing to be based on what we think avocado prices will be. And the other side of the pricing control is working directly and having a constant conversation with the suppliers and the producer directly in Mexico. 3 weeks ago, when they stopped the harvest in Mexico for 10 days and prices went up to the roof, and one of our packers in Michoacán told us, look, it's very likely that you will not have supply for 10 days in New York. So take your precaution, maybe fix the price now with your supplier, because once the news will be public knowledge on the market, it will be very, very hard to find avocados at the regular price.
And so is there a futures market for avocado? Can you buy avocados weeks ahead of time?
Well, if the demand keeps growing like this, probably yes, yeah. they will start.
They will start soon.
What happens when culturally we move on? That avocados are like bacon. It's like, yes, that's, you know, we still love them. We still love bacon. But when it's not the it food, what do you guys do then?
I mean, first of all, let's not compare avocado to bacon, please. Otherwise, I mean,
avocado didn't kill anyone yet.
Well, bacon is like, we're trying to, you know, first focus on a very different type of diet. But one of our main investments right now is into creating a food culinary department that is able to really think about what's going to be the next wave, what's going to be the next type of food that people are interested in. And, you know, I believe avocado will always be a part of what we do, but the idea is that, you know, as far as we're able to provide the people with a healthy and tasty food, that's where our mission is accomplished.
Alessandro Bigi and Francesco Bracchetti are co-founders of Avocaderia and now a new cookbook by the same name. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I asked Alessandro and Francesco about their favorite holiday avocado dishes, which is a question you can answer if you have an avocado bar. They suggested avocado chocolate mousse and avocado cheesecake, two recipes from their new cookbook. You can find those recipes at our website, marketplace.org. This final note before we go today, it comes to us from CNET. We've all got our favorite holiday songs. I love Marshmallow World, mostly because I'm a big proponent of marshmallows. But in case you're looking for a new tune to hum today, you might check out Merry Jingle-Log. Yeah, not great, but it was created by artificial intelligence and a company called Made by AI. Made by AI trained a neural network on 100 Christmas tunes and came up with songs they call Peaches Twinkle Leaves and Cinnamon Holly Bells. Unfortunately, there aren't lyrics to go along with them. Maybe next holiday. U.S. markets were closed today for Christmas. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Adrienne Hill. I hope you had a lovely holiday, and we'll see you here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.